"Make them listen to us," another voice called, and there was loud agreement and equally loud dissent. The procession began to lose its orderly form and to heave and sway. "Please, my friends!" Dr. Gould's voice was almost drowned in the uproar, and the police inspector called an order, and the reserves moved down the street and formed up behind the barricade, batons at the ready, facing the head of the procession. For some minutes the mood was ugly and confused, and then the coloured leaders prevailed, and the procession began to break up and disperse, except for a hard core of 300 or 400. All of these were young, many of them students, both black and white, and Tara was one of the few females amongst them. The police moved forward and firmly herded them away from the barricade, but spontaneously they reformed into a smaller but more cohesive band and began marching back towards District 6, the almost exclusively coloured area of the city which abutted onto the central commercial area, but whose diffuse and indistinct boundaries would be one of the subjects of the proposed legislation physically to segregate the racial groups. The younger, more aggressive marchers linked arms and began to chant and sing, and the police detachments shadowed them, firmly frustrating their efforts to turn back into the central area of the city, shepherding them towards their own areas. "Africa for the Africans!" they chanted as they marched. "We are all the same colour under the skin. Bread and freedom." Then Hubert Langley's students became more lyrical and picked up the ancient refrain of the oppressed that he had taught them. "When Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman?" The band began to play the more modern protest, "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord," and after that they launched into "Nkosi Sikelela Afrika," "God Save Africa." As they entered the narrow lanes and higgledy-piggledy alleys of District 6, the street gangs emerged to watch with interest and then to join in the fun. In the crowded streets were those with personal scores to settle, and they were also the blatantly criminal and opportunistic gang members. A half-brick came sailing in a high arc out of the packed ranks and crashed through the plate-glass window front of one of the white general dealers, a man notorious for overcharging and restricting credit. The crowd was galvanised. A woman screamed. Men began to howl like wolves in a pack. Somebody reached through the jagged hole in the shop window and grabbed an armful of men's suits. Further down the street, another window went, with a shattering of glass shards, and the police grouped more tightly and moved forward. Tara was trying desperately to help restore order, pleading with the laughing looters as they stampeded into the shops. But she was shoved aside and almost knocked down and trampled underfoot. "Go home, Whitey," one of the gang members shouted in her face. "We don't want you here." Then he ducked into the doorway of the shop and picked up a new Singer sewing machine in his arms. "Stop it!" Tara met him as he came back through the door. "Put it back. You're spoiling everything. Don't you see that's what they want you to do?" She beat her clenched fists on the man's chest, and he recoiled before her fury. However, the lane was jammed with humanity, looters, gang members, ordinary citizens, and political protesters, confused and angry and afraid. From the end of the lane, the police charged in a phalanx. Batons rising and falling, jamboks swinging, they began to sweep the mob down the street. Tara ran out of the looted store just at the moment when a large constable in dark blue uniform was laying on his baton with a will. His target, a skinny little Malay tailor, who had scampered out of his shop to try to retrieve a bolt of looted cloth. The constable hit the tailor with a full swing of the baton, crushing his red pillbox fez, and when the little man dropped on the paving stones, stooped over him to aim another blow at his head. Tara launched herself at the policeman. It was a reflex action, like a lioness protecting one of her cubs. The policeman was bent forward, his back to her, and Tara took him off balance. He went down sprawling, but Tara had a death grip on his baton and the wrist strap parted. Suddenly, she found herself armed and triumphant with the blue-jacketed enemy of the proletariat, minions of the bourgeoisie, before her. She had come in behind the rank of advancing police as they passed the shop, and their backs were turned to her. The thuds of the swinging batons and the terrified squeals of the victims infuriated her. There were the poor and the needy and the oppressed, and here were the oppressors. And here also, with raised baton, was Tara Malkomes. Normally, it would have taken Chasseur little over half an hour to drive the Jaguar from the Anreath gates of Beltevreden to the charge office in Victoria Street. This afternoon, it took him almost an hour and a good deal of fast talking. The police had cordoned off the area from Observatory Main Road right to the old fort on the extreme south end of the Grand Parade. An ominous shroud of black smoke hung over District 6 and drifted out over Table Bay, and the police at the roadblocks were tense and on edge. "You can't go in there, sir," a sergeant flanged down the Jaguar. "Nobody allowed in there. Those black bastards are throwing bricks and burning everything in sight." "Sergeant, I have just had a message," said Chasseur. "My fiancée is in there, and she needs me. She's in terrible trouble. You have to let me go to her." "Order, sir. I'm sorry." There were half a dozen constables at the barricade, four of them coloured municipal police. "Sergeant, what would you do if it were your wife or mother who needed you?" The sergeant glanced around him sheepishly. "I tell you what I'll do, sir. My men are going to open the roadblock for 1 minute, and we are going to turn our backs. I never saw you, and I don't know nothing about you." The streets were deserted but littered with debris, loose stones and bricks and broken glass that crunched under the tyres of the Jaguar. Chasseur drove fast, appalled at the destruction he saw around him, slitting his eyes against the drifts of smoke that obscured his vision every few hundred yards. Once or twice he saw figures lurking in the alleys or watching from the upper windows of the undamaged buildings. But nobody attempted to stop him or attack him. Nevertheless, it was with intense relief that he reached the police station in Victoria Road and the protection of the hastily marshalled police riot squads. "Tara Malkomes?" The sergeant at the front desk of the charge office recognised the name immediately. "Yes, you could say that we know about her. After all, it took four of my men to carry her in here." "What are the charges, sergeant?" asked Chasseur. "Let me see." He consulted the charge sheet. "So far, we have only got attending an unlawful assembly, willful destruction of property, inciting to violence, using abusive and threatening language, obstructing the police in the execution of their duty, assaulting a policeman and or policeman, common assault, assault with an offensive weapon, and or assault with intent." "I will put up her bail," said Chasseur. "That, sir, will cost a pretty penny, I should say." "Her father is Colonel Malkomes, the Cabinet Minister." "Well, why didn't you say so before? Please wait here, sir." Tara had a blackened eye, and her blouse was torn. Her auburn hair stood up in tangled disarray as she peered out at Chasseur between the bars of her cell. "What about Huey?" she demanded. "Huey can cook in Hades for all I care," said Chasseur. "Then I'm going to cook with him," Tara declared truculently. "I'm not leaving here without him." Chasseur recognised the obstinate set of her Madonna-like features and sighed. So it cost him £100. 50 for Tara and 50 for Huey. "I'll be damned if I will give him a lift, though," Chasseur declared. "£50 is enough for any little Bolshevik. He can walk back to his kennel from here." Tara climbed into the front seat of the Jaguar and folded her arms defiantly. Neither of them spoke, as Shasser gunned the motor and pulled away with unnecessary violence, burning blue smoke off the back tyres. Instead of heading back towards the affluent white southern suburbs, he sent the Jaguar roaring up the lower slopes of Devil's Peak and parked at one of the viewpoints overlooking the smoking and damaged buildings of District 6. "What are you doing?" she demanded as he switched off the engine. "Don't you want to have a look at your handiwork?" he asked coldly. "Surely you are proud of what you have achieved." She shifted uneasily in her seat. "That wasn't us," she muttered. "That was the Scully boys and the gangsters." "My dear Tara, that is how revolution is supposed to work. The criminal elements are encouraged to destroy the existing system, to break down the rule of law and order, and then the leaders step in and restore order again by shooting the revolutionaries. Haven't you studied the teachings of your idol, Lenin?" "It was the fault of the police," said Tara. "Yes, it's always the fault of the police. That's also part of Lenin's plan." "It isn't like that. Shut up," he snapped at her. "Just for once, shut up and listen to me. Up to now, I've put up with your Joan of Arc act. It was silly and naive, but I tolerated it because I loved you. But when you start burning down people's homes and throwing bricks and bombs, then I don't think it's so funny anymore." "Don't you dare condescend to me," she flared. "Look, Tara, look down there at the smoke and flames. Those are the people you pretend to care for. Those are the people who you say you want to help. Those are their homes and livelihoods that you have put the torch to." "I didn't think..." "No, you certainly didn't think. But I'm going to tell you something now, and you better remember it. If you try to destroy this land I love and make its people suffer, then you become my enemy, and I will fight you to the death." She was silent for a long time, her head turned away from him, and then at last she said softly, "Will you take me home, please?" He took the long way home, over Kloof Neck and along the Atlantic coast, circling around the far side of Table Mountain to avoid the riot-torn areas. And they never spoke again until he parked at last in front of the Malcolmus home in Newlands. "Perhaps you are right," Tara said. "Perhaps we really are enemies." She climbed out of the Jaguar and stood looking down at him as he sat behind the wheel in the open cockpit. "Goodbye, Shasser," she said softly, sadly, and went into the house. "Goodbye, Tara," he whispered. "Goodbye, my beloved enemy." All the Courtenays were gathered in the front room of Belt of Raiden. Sir Garrick and Anna sat on the long sofa, which was covered with striped Regency pattern damask. They had come down from Natal for Sir Garry's birthday, and the week before they had all climbed Table Mountain for the traditional birthday picnic. It had been a merry occasion, and the Ubas, General Jan Christian Smuts, had been with them as he nearly always was. Sir Garry and Lady Anna had planned to return home a few days previously, but then the ghastly news of the German invasion of Poland had broken, and they had stayed on at Veldt of Raiden. It was only right that the family should be together in these desperate days. The two of them held hands like young lovers as they sat close together. Since his last birthday, Sir Garry had grown a small silver goatee beard, perhaps in unconscious imitation of his old friend General Smuts. It increased his scholarly mien and added a little touch of distinction to his pale aesthetic features. He leaned slightly forward on the sofa, inclined towards his wife, but with his attention on the radio cabinet over which Shasser Courtenay was fussing, twiddling the tuning knobs and frowning at the crackle and whine of the static. "The BBC is on the 41-metre band," Santaine told him sharply, and glanced at her diamond-studded wristwatch. "Do be quick, Sherry, or we will miss the transmission." "Ah," Shassa smiled as the static cleared and the chimes of Big Ben rang out clearly. As they died away, the announcer spoke. 1200 hours, Greenwich Mean Time, and in place of the news, we are broadcasting a statement by Mr. Neville Chamberlain, the Prime Minister." "Turn it up, Sherry," Santaine ordered anxiously, and the fateful words, measured and grave, boomed into the elegant room. They listened to it all in complete silence. Sir Gary's beard quivered, and he took the steel-rimmed spectacles off his nose and absent-mindedly chewed on one of the side frames. Beside him, Anna wriggled forward onto the edge of the sofa, her thick thighs spread under their own weight. Her face slowly turned a deeper shade of brick, and her grip on her husband's hand tightened as she stared at the radio in its mahogany cabinet. Santaine sat in the tall, winged-back chair beside the huge stone fireplace. She looked like a young girl in a white summer dress, with a wide yellow ribbon around her slim waist. She was 39 years old, but there was not yet a single thread of silver in the dense, dark curls of her hair, and her skin was clear, the faint crow's feet at the corners of her eyes smoothed almost entirely by expensive oils and creams. She leaned an elbow on the arm of the chair, and while with one finger she touched her cheek, she never took her eyes off her son. Shassa paced the long room, moving from the radio cabinet in its niche between the long flowered curtains, across the highly polished parquet floor with its scattering of oriental carpets, until he reached the grand concert piano that stood against the main wall of bookcases at the far end of the room, then turning and coming back with quick, restless paces, his hands clasped behind his back, his head bowed in concentration. She thought how he looked so much like his father. Though Michael had been older and not quite so handsome, yet they had the same quality of grace. She remembered how she had believed Michael to be immortal, a young god, and she felt the terror enter her soul again, that same helpless, crippling terror, as she heard the words of war echo through this beautiful home that she had built as a fortress against the world. "We are never safe. There is no refuge," she thought. "It's coming again, and I cannot save those I love. Shassa and Blaine, they will both go, and I cannot keep them from it. Last time it was Michael and Papa. This time it's Shassa and Blaine. And, oh God, I hate it. I hate war and I hate the evil men who make it. Please, God, spare us this time. You took Michael and Papa. Please spare Shassa and Blaine. They are all I have. Please don't take them from me." The deep, slow voice spoke into the room, and Shassa froze in the centre of the floor, turning his head to stare over his shoulder at the radio, as the voice said, "And so, it is with the deepest regret that I have to inform you that a state of war now exists between Great Britain and Germany." The transmission ended and was replaced by the slow, sad strains of chamber music. "Turn it off, Sherry," Santaine said softly, and there was complete silence in the room. Nobody moved for many seconds. Then abruptly Santaine rose to her feet. She was smiling gaily as she linked her arm through Shassa's. "Lunch is ready, everybody," she cried lightly. "In such lovely weather we will eat on the terrace. Shasta will open a bottle of champagne, and I have managed to get the first oysters of the season." She kept up a bright and cheery monologue until they were all seated at the table and the wine glasses were filled, and then suddenly her act collapsed, and she turned to Sir Gary with a tortured expression. "We won't have to go in, will we, Papa? General Herzog promised he would keep us out. He says it's an English war. We won't have to send our men again, not this time, will we, Papa?" Sir Gary reached across and took her hand. "You and I know what the price was last time." His voice choked off and he could not mention Michael's name. After a moment he gathered himself. "I wish I could give you comfort, my dear. I wish I could say what you want to hear." "It's not fair," Santaine said miserably. "It just isn't fair." "No, I agree it isn't fair," said Sir Gary. "However, there is a monstrous tyranny abroad, a great evil which will swallow us and our world if we do not resist it." Santaine sprang up from the table and ran into the house. Shasta rose quickly to follow her, but Sir Gary restrained him with a hand on his arm. And 10 minutes later, Santaine came out again. She had washed her face and refreshed her makeup, and she was smiling, but there was a feverish glitter in her eyes as she took her place at the head of the table. "We are all going to be gay," she laughed. "That's an order. No brooding, no morbid thoughts or words. We are all going to be happy." She broke off, and the laughter wobbled. She had been about to say, "For it may be the last time we will all be happy together ever again." On the 4th of September, 1939, the day after Great Britain and France had declared war on Nazi Germany, General Barry Herzog rose to address the Parliament of the Union of South Africa. "It is my sad and painful duty to inform the House that the cabinet of the government is divided on the question of this country's position in the state of war that exists at present between Britain and France on the one hand and Germany on the other hand." He paused and replaced his spectacles to scrutinize the faces of the men who sat beside him on the government front benches, and then went on gravely, "It is my firm belief that the ultimatum given to Germany by the British government concerning the occupation of Poland by the German Wehrmacht is not binding upon this country, nor does the German occupation of Poland constitute a threat to the security of the Union of South Africa." A great roar of approval went up from the opposition benches, and Dr. Daniel Milan, frog-like and bespectacled, smiled benignly, while on the government benches Smuts and his supporters registered their protest as loudly. "It is rather a local matter between Germany and Poland," Herzog went on, "and it gives this country no cause to join in the declaration of war. Accordingly, I propose that South Africa remain neutral, that it cede the naval base at Simonstown to Britain, but in all other respects continue its present relationship with all the belligerents as if no war were being waged." The aging Prime Minister was a fluent and persuasive speaker, and as he continued enlarging his case for neutrality, Blaine Malcolmus, on the front bench of the government side, was covertly watching the reaction of the Smut supporters around him. He knew which of them were as firmly committed as himself and the UBAS to stand by Britain, and which of them were wavering and uncertain. As Herzog continued speaking, he sensed the swing of emotions towards the old general's side, and with a sense of disbelief and rising shame, he foresaw the ignominious decision that the House was about to take. His anger rose to keep pace with his shame. General Herzog was still speaking, and Blaine was now only listening with half an ear, as he scribbled a note to pass along to the UBAS, when abruptly his full attention flashed back to what the Prime Minister was saying. Finally, coming to the ethics of the German invasion of Poland, a case could very well be made out for the justification of this action, if it were taken into consideration, that the security of the German state. Blaine felt his spirits soar, and he sensed, rather than saw, the sudden shock and revulsion of feeling amongst those who had begun to waver towards the side of neutrality. "He has gone too far," Blaine wrote on a fresh sheet of his notepad. "He is defending Hitler's aggression. We have won." He tore the sheet from the pad and handed it to General Smuts, who read it and nodded slightly, and rose to his feet to put the other side of the argument. "Britain is our friend, our oldest and our best friend. We must stand by her to the end," he said in his high-pitched voice, rolling his R's in his distinctive Malmesbury bray. "Far from being a local dispute, the Polish invasion has consequences that reach far beyond Danzig and the corridor, into the hearts and souls of free men in every corner of the globe." When at last the motion for war or neutrality was put to the vote, Dr. Milan's nationalists voted as a bloc for neutrality, and one-third of Herzog's own party, together with three of his cabinet ministers, followed his lead. However, Smuts and his own men, Reitz and Malcolmus and Stutterford and the others, carried the day, and by the slim margin of 80 votes to 67, South Africa declared war on Nazi Germany. In a last desperate bid to thwart the declaration, General Herzog called for dissolution of Parliament and a general election. But the Governor-General, Sir Patrick Duncan, refused the request and instead accepted the old general's resignation and invited General Jan Christian Smuts to form a new government and take the nation to war. "The U-Boss won't let me go," Blaine said bitterly. And Santein ran to him across the bedroom of their cottage and stood on tiptoe to embrace him. "Oh, thank God, Blaine, my darling. I prayed and prayed, and he answered me. I couldn't bear to lose you both, not you and Chasser. I could never have survived it." "I'm not proud that I will stay at home while others go," he said. "You have fought once bravely, unselfishly," she told him. "You are 1,000 times more valuable here than lying dead on a battlefield in a foreign land." "The U-Boss has convinced me of that," he sighed. With an arm around her waist, he led her through to the sitting room, and she knew that tonight, for once, they would not make love. His distress was too great. She knew that tonight he wanted only to talk, and it was her duty to listen to him while he poured out his doubts and fears and regrets. They came out in a jumble, without logical sequence, and she sat close to him so he could touch her merely by stretching out a hand as she listened quietly. "Our position is so precarious," he said. "How can we wage a war when we command a majority of only 13 votes in the House, while against us we have a solid opposition who hate the U-Boss and what they call his English war? They will fight us every step of the way, while the people also are deeply divided against us. We have within our own borders an enemy as vicious as the Nazis, the Osewa Brandwag, and the Black Shirts and the Grey Shirts, the Deutsche Bund in South West Africa, enemies within and without." She poured him another whiskey and soda and brought him the Stuart Crystal tumbler. It was his second drink that evening, and she had never before seen him take more than one. "Pirro has betrayed us," he said. "He is one of them now. But for all those years, he has been in a position of trust." Oswald Pirro had been the Minister of Defence under the Herzog government. "We gave him a defence budget of 56 million and a brief to build up an effective modern army, but instead, he treacherously gave us a paper army. We believed his reports and his assurances, but now that he has gone, we find ourselves without modern weapons, a handful of obsolete tanks and venerable aircraft, and an army of fewer than 1,500 in the permanent force. Pyrrho refused to arm the nation for a war which he and Herzog were determined we would never fight.